Well, you're right. When you give a series of lectures like this, you're always anxious about whether you will run out of material or people first. And what you hope is that you will finish at the same time with both. I am pleased to have been included in this honoring of Professor Sizemore. You know, teachers are kind of amazing people who just hang in and hang in and hang in. And sometimes you students think you got it hard. You ought to try being a teacher sometimes. It's a honorable vocation. Mary and I have delighted to be here. We have found Midwestern inordinately hospitable. The dean and the president and the faculty and the staff and many of you have been gracious to us. I said to Mary this morning, let's build two booths and stay here. And she said, well, we would, but you ate the last breakfast roll, so you got to move on. But it is wonderful, and I am aware that I come out of a theological tradition that is some distance from yours. But you know, when you get past the code words, what you discover is that we're all about the same faith and the same gospel and the same mission. And I really do take heart from being with you, and thank you. After the preacher has talked about the saving narratives and the prophetic promises, the preacher has finally to talk about the will of God. I believe that people come to church wondering whether the preacher can talk to us about the moral coherence of the world. And there is a kind of a yearning among us to have the preacher tell us one more time that our lives have moral significance, that it matters what we do. And as you know, the preacher gets to say, God has spoken exactly 10 times, crisply, tersely, unambiguously, about obedience and command. In the whole long history of the church, consists in interpreters and many human voices trying to come to terms with those 10 commandments. It does not surprise church people that the preacher should talk about the will of God and about the commandments. That's what we're supposed to do. But I notice that people only want us to talk about the commandments the way they think they are. They basically want us to reinforce what they already thought before they came, which isn't really evangelical preaching, just to reinforce people's convictions. So it seems to me that there are two ways in which the commands of God suffer from terrible reductionisms. On the one hand, there is the reductionism of people who believe that they know fully the mind of Christ about everything. Last time the Cardinals won a World Series, I went to a game late in the season, which we won, and I didn't pay any attention to the guy sitting in front of me till the 7th inning stretch, and then he stood up and turned around, and he had written on his implement cap a very interesting hermeneutical statement: God said it, that settles it, I believe it. And I thought he probably had it all worked out. So there is the danger of a kind of sick absolutism about God's commandments. And on the other side, the reductionism that comes out of the Enlightenment and Freud, which believes that the commandments are kind of obsolete and the best thing you can do is to scuttle them for the sake of Enlightenment freedom. And I believe that the preacher is often tempted either to hammer away at the non-negotiability of the commands or to translate them into therapy so that everybody feels good. And we work between absolutism and obsolescence. But in spite of all of that, the command is a sovereign voice that continues to haunt the church. Because what God keeps saying to the church is, come be my people and Shema. Listen. It is our proper business. And listening is so tricky because the God with whom we would have communion is not a good buddy who wants us to have mindless camaraderie. And there is an amazing temptation on the left and on the right to imagine that we can get comfortable in the presence of the sovereign God. So I want to suggest that preaching on the commands about the moral significance of our life is a trickier matter than most of us are wont to say. And indeed, I think that a preacher who preaches on the commands ought not to be so concerned with getting the absolutes stated, which isn't very difficult to do, but has the harder task of asking, how is it that people are transformed and brought to durable obedience? And if you will think about the ways in which you were transformed, it wasn't by being hammered at and by having absolutes wrung out over your head. It is a much more delicate, ambiguous process than that, and that is what I want to think with you about. The preacher must insist that it is our human vocation to listen for the address of God, so that one of the great words of biblical faith is indeed Shema. And what we have to struggle with is that listening is not an easy operation in our contemporary world. I suggest it is not easy for at least two reasons, and you may think of others. It is not easy to listen because of the epistemology of modernity, which believes that what you ought to do with your life is to keep it in control. And the way you keep your life in control is always to talk and never to listen. You can tell that in the film bites of people who are running for public office. You will see them engage with people, but you will never see one of them listening. They're always explaining. That's what we do. But in the face of that, someone like Abraham Heschel, against Descartes, has written this incredible Jewish affirmation that I am commanded, and therefore I am. Well, Rosenstock Huessy has written, listen, or you will die. So the baptismal community has to struggle with a break with the epistemology of our contemporary world, and it is a scandalous break. The second reason I imagine it is so hard for us to listen is because of our economics. We are, almost all of our kinds of people, children of a disproportion. That means we got too much stuff and we got stuff that belongs to other people. And having a lot of stuff does not help you listen. You know, the statistics are clear, don't you? That the more well-off people are, the less generous people are with charities and stewardship. Isn't it odd? And it really won't do for us to struggle with the problem of epistemology if we are not at the same time struggling with our awkward economic position of affluence that gets in the way. Because what happens with this epistemology and this economics of modernity is that we are endlessly restless and anxious. We are acquisitive and we never have enough. We never have enough stuff. We never have enough ideas. We never have enough publications. We never have enough. And we really can't take a Sabbath. And by the time we come to church, I imagine, we are exhausted and fatigued and alienated. And we don't have enough energy left to listen. So the question I want to deal with is how to speak and what to say. I want to tell you my background so that you'll know I'm engaged in a great deal of projecting. But I've been a seminary teacher for 30 years. Can you imagine how many student sermons a teacher listens to in 30 years? And I have noticed, this wouldn't be true in your kind of seminary, but in my kind of seminary, most student sermons are filled with oughts and musts and shoulds. And I have made a secret decision that I have not yet told my dean, that I am not ever going to do anything that a student recommends in a sermon through a must and ought and a should, even if I agree with it. I'm just not going to. And then I thought, if a good guy like me thinks that, I wonder how many other people in the church have decided that they're not going to be dealt with through musts and oughts and shoulds. You can't really coerce people to obedience. You might reinforce people who agree with you, but you can't win people to new obedience by that mode. So how to speak? The thesis that I want to pursue with you is this, that Paul Ricoeur, I think this is true, that Paul Ricoeur has said, if you want new obedience, you got to get new imagination. If you want people to act differently, you got to help people imagine the world differently. And I suggest that it is the task of the preacher not to hammer away at obedience, but to help people imagine the world differently. And it will not surprise you if I tell you then that to imagine the world differently for the sake of new obedience requires a poet. So ethical appeal in the church, I believe, consists in helping people imagine the world through the truth of our baptism. You see, it seems to me on both the right and the left, what has happened in the reductionisms of the U.S. church is that the power for obedience has not been kept related to the claims of obedience. It matters that we are baptized. And so what the church has to talk about is how to have a baptismal conversation about a different construal of the world. So I want to suggest to you, and then I will move to greater specifics, that the fact of baptism leads us to begin with three affirmations. The first one is this, that we are lost if the vicious cycles of our life are not broken. In the public economy, in our families, in our jobs, we are all caught in vicious cycles. And the act of baptism is the affirmation that the vicious cycles have indeed been broken. That's the news that is contained in the commandments. The second affirmation that lives in baptism, I submit, is this, that God will no longer countenance the terrible disproportion of goods that exists in the world between the haves and the have-nots. That baptism is the celebration that God has made a powerful resolve for justice and peace and freedom and equality in the world, and our greedy disproportion cannot long be sustained in the face of God's resolve. So the Bible is filled with images about the disproportion being overcome, about lions and lambs sleeping together, about swords into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks, about new covenants when sins are remembered no longer, about a new shepherd king who will do justice, about planting and building and not having somebody take your stuff away from you. So baptism is an act of dreaming about the coming of God's rule in the middle of the earth. And one of the problems in the established church in its greed is that we very rarely engage in this visioning of God about the world being renovated. But it is the news. And the third facet of baptism as concerns ethics is that our lives are placed between that breaking of the vicious cycle that has already happened and the end of the disproportion that is coming soon. Or, if you like, our lives are situated between the first coming and the second coming, between the kingdom remembered and the kingdom promised. You can't talk about the commandments if you're not engaged in eschatology. So I imagine that the sermon is rarely a place for concrete moral admonition. First of all, because it doesn't do much good. And secondly, because it will likely be the reductionism of the pastor or the party or some ideology that claims to have captured the mind of Christ. I do not mean that the church should not engage in moral discernment, but I imagine that that happening in the church is likely to grow out of the sermon rather than the sermon being the place for concrete moral reflection. So I want to ask the question then, what ought we to do in the sermon? And what I want to suggest to you is that one of the things that can be done in the sermon is to help people notice that the Bible itself is a community of ongoing interpretation of the commandments. What the Bible shows is that the commandments are not flat and obvious and clear, but the commandments from Sinai are endlessly ambiguous and have always to be done over and negotiated and interpreted if they are to have anything to do with our contemporary existence. Therefore, I am suggesting that ethical preaching consists in a bold, imaginative, interpretive act about what God's ancient will has meant and meant and meant and meant over time among the baptized. And then to be saying to the baptized community that if we are to be serious about our faith, it means that we must be participants in the imaginative, interpretive act to find out what God's ancient will means now. And that is never obvious or given, but it is always a fresh decision in the community of faith. Now, what I want to do is to share with you two case studies about the imaginative, interpretive handling of the commandments within the Bible. The first one is, and I mean to suggest I will do two of them, and I think all of them can be done with this kind of interpretive sequence. The first commandment I want to talk about is keep the Sabbath. Now, that's obvious. The primal statement, as you know, of the Sabbath commandment is in Exodus 20. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor, but on the seventh you shall have a Sabbath. You and your son and your daughter and your manservant and your maidservant and your cattle and your sojourner. Because in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth and rested on the seventh. Commandment is linked to the act of creation. And what it affirms about the creation, on the one hand, is that the world is not a machine, but it is a gift that is given and given and given by God, so that Sabbath is a time to re-perceive what the world is. The second thing that the commandment affirms is that God is so confident about God's creation that God knows it will not fall apart if God goes home early one day. You see, the real reason many of us are workaholics is that we really do imagine the whole thing will fall apart if we take a break. God trusts the world more than many of us. And the other thing that I want to say in that connection, in Exodus 31, there is a remarkable statement about the Sabbath. We don't study those texts much because they're hidden back there in priestly materials, even if you don't believe the documentary hypothesis, that there's something like that. You know the word nephesh, which means self or person or sometimes soul, bad translation. It's used only three times in the Old Testament as a verb, to get nephished. And in Exodus 31, one of the three times in the niphal, that means it's passive, it says that God took a Sabbath in order to get nephished. That means the reason God took a Sabbath was to get God's life back because God was pooped. Well, that doesn't fit with scholastic theology. But you see, the whole problem is that lots of times the Bible turns up with things that do not fit our packaged theologies. So that at the beginning, Moses wants us to imagine that Sabbath is an important moment even in the life of God. And what would it mean if we were indeed made in the image of the God who needs to rest? Second, Moses thought perhaps he hadn't got it said right the first time, so he said the commandment again in Deuteronomy 5. And this time he says, keep the Sabbath, because you shall remember that you were slaves in the land of Egypt, and the Lord brought you out with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. And then it says, and on the seventh day you shall rest, and your manservant and your maidservant and your cattle and your ox and your ass, especially your ass, will be like you, ke-ka. And Hans Walter Wolff has observed that that little ke-ka, like you, means that the Sabbath is the great day of equality that overcomes all social differentiations. Well, you can see why we don't practice the Sabbath much in a greedy economy, because we do not want to take time out for a gesture of equalization. Third, in Exodus 16, the first narrative after they got out of the empire, there is a story about manna and bread marvelously given from heaven. But what has happened is that that story about manna has been turned into a statement about the Sabbath. The argument made in Exodus 16, the way it now stands, is that you ought to plan for your bread because the chief baker is going to close the bakery on the seventh day and there ain't going to be any bread from heaven. So Exodus 16 is a meditation on how to get sustenance from God. And Moses teaches Israel that you cannot store it up. It's a great statement about hoarding and accumulation and surplus wealth, because if you store it up, it's going to rot on you and turn sour and melt. And then Moses goes on to say, but there's going to be no bread given on the seventh day, so on the sixth day you can indeed store it up. But what the manna story turns out to be in relationship to the Sabbath is a statement that you ought to think about accumulation and anxiety and acquisitiveness and greed, and to notice that the world is organized well enough by God that you do not need to be in a panic about securing your own existence. A Jewish scholar, Talmon, has written in a book that Sabbath is the one day he hands his life back to God to recognize that he is not self-made. Fourth, in Amos 8, a long time after Moses, what the prophet says is that the Sabbath is a defense thrown up by the gospel to protect the weak against the strong. And Amos says, hear this, you who trample the needy and destroy the poor of the land, you who say, how soon will the Sabbath be over so that we can get back to our exploitation? And then he goes on to say, you keep doing that and you're going to die. The Sabbath is a day to stop the commercial systemic greed that destroys the vulnerable and the weak. Fifth, 200 years after Amos, according to critical judgment, the first text in the text that is critically called 3rd Isaiah, what they're doing is trying to establish order in the post-exilic community. And they apparently had a big argument about who gets in and who has to stay out. And Isaiah 56 makes an incredible affirmation saying, you can let everybody in. You can let foreigners in. You can let eunuchs in. You can let people who have all kinds of odd sexual histories into the community. And they only got two requirements. One is, they got to keep the covenant. Well, of course, I knew he'd say that. That's basic. And the second one, of all of the laws of the Torah that he might have picked out to establish a community, the only other thing the outsider's got to do to get in is to keep the Sabbath. Isn't that amazing? To keep the Sabbath, to make a gesture to ourselves and a gesture to the world that we are not organizing our life according to the production schedules of the empire. That we are a distinct community that move from and toward a different purpose in our life. So the Sabbath commandment becomes a discussion about how to organize a human community outside production quotas. And sixth of the last I shall mention, in Mark 2 and Matthew 12, Jesus and his disciples are walking through a grain field, and they do like farmers do. They just check a few to see if harvest time has come yet. And the holy people said it was a shame because they said it was working on the Sabbath. And then Jesus commits an extraordinary hermeneutical act. He says that the Sabbath was made for human persons and not human persons for the Sabbath. What Jesus does is to subordinate the commandment to the well-being of the community. And then he stands up straight and he says, I am the Lord of the Sabbath. So pay attention. Now, what I think is important about this sequence is that it doesn't tell us what the commandment means for us. It doesn't tell us how to keep the commandment and to celebrate the Sabbath in our technological urban society. What it does tell us is that the community of faith has had to exercise enormous freedom and enormous imagination time after time to find out what God's commandment ought to mean now and how obedience would look if we could find a way and the courage to be obedient. So there is here no strict constructionism that imagines it can read it off the page. There is here no authorial intent that says this is what it meant to Moses. But it is always an act of liberated hermeneutics that wants to keep pushing and pushing to new forms of obedience. So I think that the Sabbath among us resonates with the statement of Augustine that our hearts are restless until they find their rest in God. And the preacher's theme is restlessness. and the awareness in the baptismal community that restlessness permeates all of our life, economic and political and sexual and psychological and theological. And this deep restlessness among us that breeds brutality and violence bespeaks a fundamental disorder in our life that reflects a distortion in our relationship with God. And the baptismal community is invited to think through again what would need to happen for us to purge from our common existence the deep restlessness that leaves us endlessly on edge toward our neighbor. See, we're not into absolutism. We're certainly not into obsolescence of the commandment. But what we are into is a hard evangelical act of imagination that knows that obedience has got to be as new and as daring as today. The other commandment that I will run through quickly is the 10th, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife or your neighbor's field or his manservant or his maidservant or his ox or his ass or anything that is your neighbor's. Marvin Cheney has convinced me, I think he's right, that the 10th commandment has to do with land tenure systems and management policies. That is, it concerns the way we systemically practice coveting through loans and credits and tax and inheritance and capital gains. It is concerned with the systemic practice of greed whereby the big ones eat up the little ones. If you want to, you can say it concerns the farm crisis. Moses at Mount Sinai is laying down the guideline that it is possible to organize social power and land and the means of production to have a different kind of society. You see, what we've done in the church is basically reduce the commandments to private little acts with each other. And what Cheney has shown, I think, is that this commandment does concern dangerous questions of social policy and social practice. And people need help with that. So I shall mention 5 extrapolations. First, in Micah 2, verses 1 to 5, Micah is a little elder from the village of Meresheth Gath, south of Jerusalem. And what he seems to be doing is to watch the big banking system in Jerusalem buying up all the land. Sounds contemporary, doesn't it? So he says, woe. That's how it starts. Woe. That means you're going to die. Woe. Woe to those who devise wickedness and work evil on their beds. You know, if you got a broker and a phone, you don't have to get out of bed early to cheat people. You can do it late. Don't you wonder what time Donald Trump gets up in the morning? The time he gets up, he probably owns something else. What this oracle goes on to say, which is an exegesis of the 10th commandment. The problem with these people is that they covet people's land and people's houses and people's fields. And the poet Micah says, there's going to come a day and you better call the women grievers because you're going to do a lot of crying and you're going to weep at what you lost when the market collapses and it's all taken away from you because thou shalt not covet. And the poem concludes with this enigmatic little statement, you shall have none to cast the line by lot in the assembly of the Lord. What that means is there's going to be a meeting at the courthouse and they're going to draw property lines. And they're going to say, you get 80 acres, and you get 160, and you get 640, and you get 80. And those guys are not even going to get into the meeting. The Bible believes that the land is going to be redistributed against coveting because God wants all God's people to have turf. Second, the most dangerous text in the Old Testament is Leviticus 25, the teaching of the Jubilee year, which is the teaching, you know, that after 49 years, you've got to give it back. You got to give it back to stupid, careless people who can't take care of them. You say, why give it back to them? Because in 20 years, the same people will have it again. I know that. But every 49 years, you got to go back to go and collect $200. It's an exegesis of the 10th commandment. I have never talked about the year of the Jubilee in my liberal tradition without some well-meaning person saying, there's no evidence, is there, that they ever did it? My cynical response has become, this is filled with things they never did. But isn't it interesting? Isn't it interesting that this law is the one people want to get rid of because it is the most dangerous threat to our economic monopoly? I had a pastor friend in Iowa who said that the banker in his little town owned his bank. It wasn't owned in Chicago, which gave him some freedom. And in the middle of the farm crisis, he simply extended all the farmers' mortgages 2 years without interest. Because he says, this is my town and these are my neighbors and I want to live here. And the pastor said he didn't know it, but the banker was practicing the Jubilee year. It's a way to have a conversation in the community of the baptized about economic policy. Because one of the evangelical questions is, shall we let debts destroy neighborliness? And the market economy says yes. We don't care about neighborliness. We care about debts. Third, in Isaiah 61, still this same text where they're trying to organize the post-exilic community, you know the text well. The wind of God has blown upon me because he has appointed me to preach good tidings to the afflicted, to open the prisons of those who are bound, and to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. And most scholars believe the acceptable year of the Lord is simply the Jubilee year. The post-exilic community has a proposal on the table that we become the community that practices the Jubilee year to show that we're not going to organize our community around debts the way the Persian Empire has organized things around debts. And the fourth text you know very well is Jesus' quote in Luke 4 of Isaiah 61, in which he said the same thing. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord, to bring good news to the poor. Well, what news to the poor could possibly be spoken except the cancellation of debts? And it is an argument of many scholars now that what Jesus is doing, particularly in the Gospel of Luke, is that he is implementing the Jubilee year. He has given stuff back to people who have lost it. I don't know whether that's right, but the question in the church is, what kind of a Jesus is this that we've got on our hands? In the fifth text that I shall mention, in Luke 12, these two brothers come to Jesus, and they say, would you please divide up our dad's estate? Well, if you've ever lived in a rural community, you know that the most dangerous thing to do is to be a probate judge. Because what a probate judge is to sort out the farm when the guy dies. In every rural community I've ever lived in, there are large extended families, and there are always two branches of it that do not speak to each other. And the reason they don't speak to each other is that two generations ago, Grandpa's farm got divided wrongly. So Jesus said, oh no, I'm not a probate judge. But he said, what I am is a rabbi, and I will tell you a story. And so he tells the story about the man that built bigger and bigger and bigger barns because he was into free market acquisitiveness. And finally he held a party at night and nobody came, and he held a party all alone. Except one voice did come, and that voice came and said in the night at the party, fool, die. It's just a parable. And then Jesus says to his disciples, you know why you covet? It's because you have such little faith. So what the 10th commandment is all about, I think, is that coveting kills. And the preacher's theme is greed. and greed touches every aspect of our life. Economic, political, sexual, psychological, theological, and greed bespeaks a fundamental disorder in our life that reflects a distortion in our relationship with God. The baptismal community gathers around the commandments to think through again how our common life could be organized in ways alternative to greed. Now I want you to notice about these two commandments how much I've said and how little I've said. Because the purpose of preaching is not to get somebody to rush out and to commit an overt act of obedience. People may or may not do that. The purpose of preaching, I imagine, is to give people courage and freedom to be present in the world differently. And I know that when church is over, people go home and they're the same way they were. Except the question will have been put that haunts. And that is the question about why do we live the way we live? Do you think our restlessness will ever satisfy us? Do you think our greed will ever secure us? And we are haunted by the presence of the commandment that is not simply a rule, but is an invitation to another kind of existence. So I believe that what our society needs more than anything else is that it needs poets who can take these commandments and walk around them and walk around them. It requires rabbis who tell stories and poets who imagine that outsiders are entitled to rest and all of us could be different. I don't expect quick miracles, but I imagine that the miracle of obedience could happen to us if we are aware that obedience lives on the lips of the poet who energizes and authorizes and liberates people for commandments that are indeed a more excellent way.
Standing a moment, I want to present to Dr. Brueggemann a memento of your visit here, that you will remember us perhaps longer than you would otherwise, and remember the gratitude that we hold in our hearts for your being here and the words you've spoken to us as the poet among us. And we're grateful for Dr. Mary Brueggemann, who's been here also, and for her contributions to us during these days. Thank you for being present for this memorable time in the B.A. Sizemore Lectures.